All right, welcome back to 20 minute Human Geo in 20 minutes. I'm your host, Mr. Linder. Today we are going to be talking about Unit 3, culture. Specifically, we're focusing on pop culture and folk culture, as well as language for this upcoming test this week. So let's get right into it. Just going right off of the study guide. What types of diffusion can explain how language and culture spread? First of all, anytime we're talking about diffusion, we're talking about the spread of a trait or some sort of cultural experience from its hearth, which is where it starts from, spreading throughout a population. Anytime it's talking about movement of people, people moving somewhere or anything like that, it is almost always referring to relocation diffusion. Then we have relocation diffusion, then we have expansion diffusion, which expansion diffusion breaks down into three subtypes: stimulus, which we're not really going to focus on today, hierarchical, and contagious. Hierarchical, if it comes from a group of people that are in power, if it comes from colonizers, if it comes from the government, if it comes from a celebrity or something like that, that's going to be hierarchical diffusion. If it's just kind of talking about the widespread growth throughout a population, people being closer to the hearth, experiencing it at first or anything like that, then it's usually talking about contagious diffusion. Usually folk culture is going to spread through relocation diffusion. Pop culture is going to spread through contagious or hierarchical diffusion. Define cultural imperialism and apply it to a real world situation. So with cultural imperialism, you're talking about like when one group's culture is kind of infringing on another or taking over popular culture. And usually in modern terms, we're talking about how the United States in our popular culture is kind of taking over the world and infringing on local cultures. And one of the best ways that we can look at that is the fact that McDonald's operates in like 170 different countries. They tailor their menu in certain cases to fit the country that they're in. But the fact that like things like McDonald's, American pop music, American movies are all over the globe, those are examples of cultural imperialism. What does the term isogloss refer to? Isogloss is just talking about like a language barrier. It could be, like a mountain or a river or just the border between two countries, but it is talking about like a language barrier that separates two linguistic groups from one another. What is unique about the Basque language and where are most Basque speakers found? The Basque language is unique because even though it is located in like right in between the Pyrenees Mountains, between France and Spain, it is not an Indo-European language. And Indo-European languages diffused to that part of Europe sometime around 3 or 4,000 BC. So the Basque language has been there for at least 6,000 years, if not much, much longer. And so it's unique because it is one of the few isolated language spots in Western Europe that is not related to the Indo-European language family. Know the major language families. So Indo-European is the largest. We talked about the four major branches there. We talked about Romance, which contains Latin and French and Spanish and Italian, amongst others. Talked about the Germanic branch. It contains German and Danish and English. We talked about the Balto-Slavic branch. It contains Russian and Serbian and Croatian. And then we talked about the Indo-Iranian branch, which is more in the eastern part of the globe. That's where you get Hindi. That's where you get Farsi, Kurdish, Pashto, some of the languages that are spoken in South Asia, Central Asia, and in parts of the Middle East. The next largest family is the Sino-Tibetan language family, and it's the next largest because it contains Mandarin, which is the largest first language spoken in the globe. It's spoken by, close to 800 or 900 million people in China. But that is definitely the largest language that's spoken in the Sino-Tibetan language family, and even including Mandarin, Sino-Tibetan is still does not have nearly as many speakers as the Indo-European language families do. Afro-Asiatic language family, we're mainly talking about North Africa and the Middle East, and the two specific languages we looked at were Arabic and Hebrew. And then lastly, we've got the Niger-Congo language family, which is mainly referring to sub-Saharan Africa, and we're usually talking about Swahili when we're talking about the Niger-Congo family. What does the term toponym refer to? Be sure to understand what this looks like around the world. So toponym is just talking about a place name, and place names can be reflective of the culture. Places like, where you're going to find like large Catholic populations, usually the cities are like St. Paul or St. Louis or something like that. It reflects that, that religious background. Other times, especially in the former Soviet Union, you're going to have like, Leningrad or Stalingrad or whatever that are, you know, kind of glorifying the leaders of their, of their country, which Stalingrad, Leningrad, literally just means like city of Lenin, city of Stalin or whatever. So those are a couple different ways that toponyms can reflect the culture. Compare and contrast popular and folk cultures. All right. So first of all, with popular culture, it's going to be much, much more widespread, which means it's going to appeal to a heterogeneous group of people. There are people all over our country. There are people all over the world that are like the same pop culture. So it can appeal to a large group of people. But what pop culture usually means is it usually means that it's something that is, it kind of goes in fads. And so like it changes over time and it kind of changes relatively quickly, just based on kind of the fad of the day. With pop culture, you're also going to get uniform landscapes, right? Like malls kind of all look the same. They all have the same stores. Most suburbs throughout America, you're going to find a bunch of fast food. You're going to find a bunch of like Harris Teeter, like grocery stores. And it's just all the same. And that is popular culture. With folk culture, it's usually small, isolated, homogeneous groups of people. So you've got like the Amish or different Native American groups or Cajuns or people like that. And their culture only moves and changes through relocation diffusion, whereas pop culture is definitely more hierarchical and contagious diffusion. Folk culture doesn't change a lot over time. It takes a long, long time to change anything in Amish culture. And a lot of that is because stuff is handed down from family to family. And it's not coming from different sources like it does with popular culture. And it adds more diversity to a country. The more, even though pop culture appeals to heterogeneous groups, folk culture adds more diversity because you're talking about these different isolated groups that have their own unique cultures that definitely add to the American mosaic over time. So those are some of the differences between popular culture and folk culture. Why are some languages under the threat of extinction? First of all, as English becomes the world's premier lingua franca, it is definitely the language of business. It is the language of popular culture. That means that other cultures are starting to lose their languages. Also, as people get conquered and as minority groups, die out or lose their ability to govern themselves, then oftentimes they have to adapt or adopt the language of the dominant group. Again, you look at countries that had different empires during the age of imperialism. Great Britain had an empire that stretched all the way around the world. English is, spoken largely because of that and because of American cultural and economic dominance today. But even like French and German and Portuguese, like these languages, Spanish, like these languages are spoken around the world because of these imperialist dynasties that existed by these European countries. And so as isolated groups, like groups in the Amazon and certain groups in India and Papua New Guinea, as they just start to die out and start to get smaller and smaller, and as technology creeps more and more into their lives, then they start to lose their culture. And usually the first thing that goes when you're losing your culture is you're losing your language. What is meant by a proto-language? Proto just means like previous or before. So a proto-language is a theoretical common ancestor that existed way, way back thousands and thousands of years ago. And when I say theoretical common ancestor, I mean theoretical language common ancestor. So if I wanted to know, like, all right, 10,000 years ago, what was the language that was spoken by Indo-European language speakers? It was just proto-Indo-European, which means like pre-Indo-European. What about the language that was spoken by Sino-Tibetan language speakers 20,000 years ago? Oh, I don't know. It's proto Sino-Tibetan, because no one knows what those languages were, because they were thousands and thousands of years ago. They've grown, they've changed, they've evolved, they've gone extinct. And so Proto-Indo-European doesn't exist anymore. It's just a theoretical common language that did exist thousands and thousands of years ago that eventually all the other Indo-European languages evolved from. compare and contrast assimilation and acculturation. So with assimilation, you were talking about a minority group or a, definitely usually talking about immigrant groups that try to blend into the dominant culture as quickly as they possibly can. They are oftentimes giving up their language, they're giving up their clothing, their way of life, their sometimes their religion to try to blend into the dominant culture. I've used examples of people who have had kind of what we would consider like crazy or weird last names that just shortened them and made them more American or usually more English just to make it easier. I talked about a former teacher here whose husband's last name is Simone, which was shortened from Simonovich Tavitsky a long, long time ago just to make it a lot easier. So that is assimilation. And that's when we talk about like the melting pot of America, that we all kind of blend into this bland one ideal of what America is. And that is what assimilation is talking about. With acculturation, immigrant groups are trying to hold on to their culture as much as they possibly can while still trying to move up socioeconomically. So if you want to move up socioeconomically in the United States and you're an immigrant, that means you have to have a job. And to get a job, usually you have to dress American and usually you have to speak American. So oftentimes speak as an American, speak English. We speak English in America sometimes. So what that means is that you might still maintain your religious practices. You might keep holidays and things like that. You might speak your common language at home, but you might speak English in the workplace. But with acculturation, you're trying to maintain as much of your culture as you can while still kind of being a part of this new American culture. And so that's where we get like the American mosaic that, hey, like you come from this place, I come from this place. We all add our own unique ingredients to this beautiful American picture. And that's why we have places that celebrate, Oktoberfest, and why we have all sorts of different Mexican restaurants and Chinese restaurants and Ethiopian restaurants. And we have different cultural days and cultural festivals, depending on the town and who the town was settled by and that sort of thing. And so that is acculturation, definitely trying to hold on to your culture as much as you possibly can. Also remember, especially with a language, it usually takes three generations for an immigrant's language to die out. So if I was the one who migrated from another country to the United States, and let's say I spoke German, by the time that my grandkids are born, my grandkids would most likely not learn any German at all. So my kids would be bilingual, but then their kids would not, they would only speak English. All right, what is meant by a global lingua franca? What is the current lingua franca? How does the world work to accommodate this? A lingua franca is a commonly understood language. And today that is English. And that's for a couple reasons. Number one, again, we can go back to English dominance during the age of imperialism. We can talk about American dominance, whether imperialistically or economically, since World War II. It's definitely the language of business. But again, if we go back to, the dawn of the Spanish Empire, 1492, then Spanish would be the lingua franca. If you want to talk about during the Roman Empire, then Latin would be the world's lingua franca. And again, it can be regional too. In South America, the lingua franca is Spanish. In Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, the lingua franca is Swahili. In North Africa, the lingua franca is Arabic. In China, the lingua franca is Mandarin. In India, it's Hindi. Hopefully we get the picture. And how does the world work to accommodate this? Again, like the country that is the most culturally or the most economically dominant is going to be the one whose language is the most widely spoken. And the last two countries really that have been the most dominant are the United States and Great Britain, going back a couple hundred years. And so that is why you have English as the world's lingua franca today. What are dialects? Dialects are just local derivations of a language. So in the United States, we looked at a couple different maps. We look at one map that shows us that we have like five different dialects from southern U.S. to northeast U.S. Those can be broken down a little bit further, though. We watched the video where the girl spoke like 26 different dialects or whatever it was. And not all of them were from the United States, but we know in the United States, if I go to Chicago, I'm going to come across a distinct accent. If I go to, you know, Los Angeles, California, there's kind of a distinct accent. Like Minnesota up north, Boston, Brooklyn, Charleston, like all these places have kind of very distinct accents, which, I know all of you are probably dying for me to, deliver those here, but that's not going to happen because I am not talented at that. And it's 8:25 in the morning and, I just don't feel like doing it. Moving on. Define ethnocentrism. It's the idea that your ethnicity, your ethnic group, your culture is superior to other people's. We are definitely guilty of this in the United States. How many languages exist today? Where are the most linguistically diverse places on earth? There are somewhere between 5,000 and 6,000 languages that are spoken today, but by 2100, it'll be closer to 1,000. Places like the Amazon rainforest, you have in Pacific Islands, you have languages that are just very, very close to dying out. But the most linguistically diverse places on earth, the two most linguistically diverse countries are India and Papua New Guinea. India makes sense. It's large. It's a large geographically. It's large population-wise. There's over 1 billion people. It's diverse geographically. It's diverse religiously. So it makes sense that there'd be a lot of languages there. Papua New Guinea is more interesting. It is just a super mountainous, super isolated country. But those two countries, Papua New Guinea and India, are the most linguistically diverse places on earth. And finally, what is meant by the term language family? A language family is just referring to a large group of languages that share common origins. So when we talked about Indo-European, we talked about how we know that they probably moved from like a cold weather place because there were common words for like cold or winter or ice or snow or something like that. And so those common words existed. So we know that they share the same origins, and that's just what it means to be a part of a language family. There are common origins for different words and different parts of speech. All right, so that gets us through part one. Definitely kept it under 20 minutes this time. Best of luck. Obviously, if you have any questions, email, come see me, come to the review sessions, all that good stuff. Thanks again for listening, and good luck on the test.